Today's Teisho is Case 23 from the Book of Serenity. Case 23 is entitled, Lu Zhu Faces the Wall. Introduction. Bodhi Dharma's 9 years is called Piquan, wall gazing. Shengguan's 3 vows divulge the natural potential. How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. Nan Chuan, hearing this, said, I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty aeon, to understand before the Buddha appears in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Lu Zhu, that way, will go on till the year of the ass. Verse. In plainness, there's flavor. Subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign, unbending like an idiot, his path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar. So thank you so much for coming today to practice and for sitting so well, both online and in person. People are really sitting deeply. It's wonderful to see that. Thank you so much. And of course, we encourage each other. Okay, so this is about a Zen teacher named Lu Zhu, and his method is would be the following. Let's say that here at Rutgers, next week I'm invited to go to speak to the Buddhist Club here at Rutgers, and as soon as I get into the room, everybody's going to assemble, and what I should do is immediately turn and face the wall, and people would scratch their heads and wonder, where's the lecture, where's the... So Lu Zhu was like that. You know, when he sees people coming, as soon as he sees them coming, he immediately runs into the zendo and faces the wall, right? And of course, you know, they're coming for instruction in Zen, and his practice is baffling to them, right? As soon as they come into the temple, he immediately sees them, he turns around, he runs over and faces the wall. So Nan Chuan says, that method will never work, right? I mean, they will. I usually talk to them about the Dharma before I ask them to sit. See, in that way. Remember that when in Zen koans, when somebody's insulting somebody else, it's usually a compliment. So what he's really saying here is, he seems to be criticizing Lu Zhu, but Nan Chuan is actually saying this is a very pure method. Basically, that's sort of what the upshot is. So, For thousands of years, you know, people have lived for a future life. You know, not just in the Christian world, but in many different societies. You know, so like in the Islamic world too. You know, Christians have this idea that when they die, they will be judged and they will go to heaven, right? And And Muslim have something like that, very similar, right? They believe in a day of judgment and so on. And, you know, people, you know, believe that, you know, when I die, I'm going to go to heaven. And when I go to heaven, you know, it will be a very good place, a very nice place. And, you know, if it's very common to hear people in the past said things like, you know, if you're hungry here, you'll eat in heaven. And if you're lonely here in heaven, you'll have friends, right? You know, basically, if you've been cheated here, you'll be rewarded in heaven, and so on. These beliefs are very, very common, right? You know, all over the world. And, you know, the idea is that, you know, it's a mistake to live for today, for just this life, because a better life is coming. You'll hear this, you know, if you watch evangelical TV on you know, on cable television, they say this all the time. They'll say, you know, live for your future existence. So this is the way, you know, people have been for, you know, really thousands of years. But, you know, in our time, you know, in the modern world, a lot of people reject that. You know, people may still believe in heaven, but a lot of people will say, you know, that's crazy. You know, we get one life and we should really live it to the fullest, you know. And, you know, I actually think in some ways, that's a really healthy thing, right? So, you know, if you're unhappy with your life now, you know, instead of saying, okay, well, in my next life, this will be resolved, you know, being happy with your life now or unhappy with your life now and doing something about it is a really good strategy sometime, right? Not just wishing that in some future heaven you will be, your needs will be met, but trying to meet them here. And I think that in some ways is a really big improvement. You know, one of the reasons I think Zen is so popular, or Buddhism is so popular in the West and in the modern world in general, is because it really emphasizes, you know, the importance of living this life, see. So, you know, I know lots of people who have said, you know, you're not going to get when I was growing up, I had friends who we would have these debates, and they would say, no, this is it. You know, well, you're not going to get another life. There's no... this is the one you get. You've got to do something with it. And I think lots of people in the modern world, you know, find Buddhism really appealing. There are certainly Buddhists who believe in heaven. You may not know this, but in Buddhism there are actually multiple hells and there are multiple heavens. And many people who follow Pure Land schools of Buddhism, and there are hundreds of millions of such people, you know, they do believe that they will be born in a kind of heaven, in a paradise of a bodhisattva named Amida or Amitabha. And they, you know, so lots of Buddhists do believe like in a world beyond. It's a little different, because the goal when you get there is still to practice and achieve enlightenment. But, you know, the Buddhism that is so popular in our culture, in the West, is the this life is it, you know, Buddhism. Be here now. Right? So, you know, I think there's even a book on Buddhism called Be Here Now, right? There's a book by a guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn the title is Wherever You Go, There You Are. So, you know, I think his point is you're always here in the present. You're always here in the moment. And I do think that that's, to a point, that's a really valuable philosophy, you know? So when I was younger, I was the kind of person who was very withdrawn. I was sort of an introvert. And when I was in high school, you know, my idea of a good time was to just spend the weekend reading a novel. Right? So, you know, I did do some sports. I was involved in high school sports. But, you know, I stayed out of the center of things. I was always sort of on the margins of things. And I was sort of a very dreamy guy. You know, I would read these novels, and I would be sort of lost in my head a lot of the time, very dreamy person. And I remember when I went to college, I had to find a job, right? I had to get a job that would pay a certain amount of money for, because of, you know, I didn't have financial resources. I had to work in the summer. And I had to find a job that paid a reasonable amount of money because I needed that money to get through school. I had some financial support, but I didn't have enough. So I actually had the chance to work construction, you know, as a laborer in a construction site, because that paid really well at the time. And it was such a shock. It was a shock for many reasons. First of all, I had been pretty protected in my childhood and early youth, and suddenly I was on this construction site, and you know, from 7 a.m. until like 5 p.m. or something like that, 8 to 5, something like that, we were working so hard. I had never physically worked so hard in my life. Literally, I was digging ditches some of the time, right? You know, so we had to dig these ditches for the cement foundations for a building. They're called footings. And I had to dig the ditches and then put metal rods in the ditch after it was all cleaned up and tie them off. They're like steel rods, and they get tied with little wires. They all have to be done exactly right. And, you know, doing a footing for one of these apartment complexes took like weeks, really, digging it out with a team of other laborers. And then putting in the rods, the support rods, tying them off, and then the cement truck would come. And we would spend, you know, the cement truck would back up to these trenches that we dug, and the chute would come into the trenches, and then we would take these rakes and pull the cement down through these trenches. And it was backbreaking work, and it would go on and on. And when I would come home, I would be so exhausted. And my hands were very soft, you know, so I used to have all these blood blisters on my hands, you know, and this was before workers' gloves and things like that. So, you know, for about 2 weeks, I was really in agony until my hands got tougher. But this was such a shock to me in another way, too, because I really had to pay attention. You know, I was this dreamy guy. You know, I literally would spend my days in high school, you know, when I wasn't studying, I was walking around reliving these novels in my head, having conversations, you know. And suddenly I'm on this construction site, and you had to pay attention 24, you know, it was a 9-hour day or something, 9 hours a day you had to pay attention. You know, I used to put these steel rods in the trenches, and they had to be done exactly right. And the foreman would come around and inspect them, and he would get on my case if they weren't done right. You know, he'd say, no, no, and he'd tear it all up, and he'd yell at me, and, you know, and I had not developed the ability to pay close attention, right, you know. So a couple times, you know, he almost threatened to fire me, and I needed this job. So it's like I have to do this right, you know. And I began to get so good at tying these off that I became the person who did the tying, right, you know. So he would rely on me to do it right. And it was, I had a great sense of pride at doing it right, but you really had to pay attention. They had to be a certain height above the bottom of the trench. They had to be a certain distance from each other. You know, a inspector from the county would come and inspect these, and he would shut the place down if it wasn't right. So it had to be, you know. So I really began to learn how to pay attention. And you have to pay attention on construction sites for other reasons too. You know, people are going by with these moving vehicles. You can get hit. Things can fall on your head. You know, you can step into a trench, you know. It was such a education in being attentive and being in the moment. And it really sort of like retrained my brain, right? It was such a good experience. Later, when I would do other jobs that required, you know, close attention, close work, I eventually started working as a carpenter, you know, and you have to be able to read blueprints, and you have to be able to follow the blueprints and make precise cuts. You have to measure twice and cut once, you know, and it completely sort of changed me as a person. I learned how to pay attention. And years later, when I was in graduate school, I had a summer job working for a wonderful man named Andy Shiga. He owns a store that he owned, it's long gone, but he owned an import store in Seattle, in the University District, called Shiga's Imports. And my wife actually worked for him as a buyer for Shiga's Imports with his wife, Toshimo. And he knew I was a needy graduate student, and so he gave me a summer job refurbishing the second floor of his house in Seattle. And I had to do some carpentry work, but I also had to paint everything. And there was a guy on the site, working with me named Neil. Neil was a PhD in musicology. And somehow he had met Andy, and Andy Shiga was this very nice man. And somehow he had said to Neil, "Do you want to come and make some money this summer?" And Neil had said yes. So anyway, I was doing the carpentry, and Neil's job was to paint the walls. And Neil, you know, was like me when I was younger. He was a total space cadet. You know, he was lost in thought, and everything he did was screwed up, like, to the max, right? So, you know, when you've probably done painting, you know, when you paint a wall with a roller, the first thing you do is put a drop cloth down. Because unless you're like a really expert painter, when you paint, you're going to drop drops of paint on the floor. So you put a drop cloth down, and then, you know, as you're painting, you have to be very careful not to step in the wet paint on the drop cloth. So, you know, Neil, he was such a space cadet, right? He there were huge puddles of paint in the drop cloth, and then he walked through those paint puddles across the floor, and he didn't even notice, you know. One day we were working, and I was concentrating on reframing this window, right, and rehanging this sash window, so I had to pull the covers off, you know, the frame off, and inside are the broken, there's a little rope that holds two sash weights, and that's why when you raise the window it goes up so easily. Those sash weights go up and down. They're very heavy, and they make the window feel very light. And one of the sash weights, the string had broken, and I was trying to thread it through a little wheel, right? And anyway, Andy had come upstairs, Andy Shiga had come upstairs to inspect, and he saw, it was like a trail of ruin, you know. Neil had painted, walked through the paint, and there, you could follow his footprints, you know, down out the back door, right? So, you know, Andy was really a nice man, but he finally had to get rid of Neil because Neil just couldn't make that transition, right? He couldn't be in the moment. And you know, maybe it paid off as a musicologist, right? Maybe, you know, music theory, you don't have to be, but you know, when you listen to music, to hear music, you really have to be in the moment. And I think in a lot of ways, many people are sort of like the way I was, and they're like the way Neil is. You know, some of our withdrawal from the world is defensive, right? It's a defensive strategy, right? You know, we develop a habit of not being present in the moment because sometimes a moment is so challenging and difficult that it's easier to lose yourself in thought or lose yourself in dream, right? There was a guy who was coming to sit with us for a while. This was many years ago. But he would come in here and he would use every cushion and pillow he could get his hands on. So after I showed him how to meditate, he would take like three mats and sit, and then he would take all the spare zafus and stick them under his legs, under his knees, so he'd have like two zafus under his bottom, two zafus under his leg, and it was preposterous, right? And he'd do it every time. And I finally had a chance to talk to him, and I said, you know, why are you doing that? You know, can't you just function with one zafu under your bottom and just have your... And he said, but the pain is so intense. And I talked to him about the pain, and I gave him strategies like watching the breath. You know, at some point, he started to see a therapist. It turned out that he had other issues going on. And he came back to talk to me, and I didn't ask him, but he just said, you know, he said, my therapist said, you know, I spend a lot of my time in a dream world, in a fantasy world. And I guess when he had to confront pain, it brought him out of his fantasy world and forced him to be in the moment, and that was maybe more unpleasant than the physical discomfort. So, you know, he wrote me years later. He got some job in another city, and he wrote me years later about, you know, making a lot of progress with these issues. But I don't think it's so unusual. I think people develop this habit of not being present, right? You're in sort of a dreamy state where you're like 30% present or 40% present, and it's sort of comfortable and dreamy to be in that state. So I think one of the things I learned working construction and not suffering a terrible accident on a construction site was how to pay attention. But when I did Zazen too, you know, you really learn how to pay attention, how to be in the moment. And you realize, you know, when you begin to do Zazen, how difficult it is to be in the moment. You know, it's as soon as we sit down on the cushion, our minds are off to the races, right? You're in your fantasy mode, right? Or your thinking mode. And it's very hard to like drag your mind back to the present moment. So you know, a lot of early Zen practice, and many people get discouraged and they quit, is just learning how to move through those thoughts and be present in the here and now. And I often think that the dreaminess or the, you know, being so in the thoughts is kind of a defense mechanism. I really believe that. It's a way we can create a cocoon of thought around ourselves that insulates us from things that can be scary or uncertain. And, you know, one of the great discoveries I think people make in the process of learning how to meditate is that, you know, little by little, the more time we spend in the moment, you know, the better we begin to feel. Right. I think that's true. You know, if you have been practicing meditation for a year or two, you may have this experience where you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and you're able to be with the breath rather consistently for certain stretches of time. Nobody's entirely in the moment in any half-hour section of time, right? That would be extraordinary. So, you know, we are in the dreamy state during some period of every sit. But, you know, there are these intervals where we're really there, we're with the breath, or we're focused on the koan. And, you know, when we come out of that sit, when that sit ends, or even during the sit, you know, sometimes you can have this feeling, it's so wonderful. It's like, you know, some of us have been sitting since 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock. After the Saturday sit today, you may go outside and, you know, just seeing the wind move through the trees may be extraordinary. Just see, it feels wonderful. Right? So, you know, basically being able to sort of cut through the fantasy and be present in the moment is so liberating sometimes. It's like, you know, we realize sometime when we're able to cut through our thoughts and be in the moment that we actually feel sometimes better in the moment. You know, you realize I've been defending myself all this time. I've been wrapping myself in the cocoon of thought, you know? And what have I been doing that for? You know, the moment, being in the moment is actually really kind of wonderful, really kind of wonderful. So, you know, I don't know if my friend Neil ever heard about Buddhism or not, or Zen, or I don't know whatever happened to him after Andy terminated him, unfortunately. But meditation would have helped him. It would have taught him how to cut through that cocoon of thinking and dreaming, and to be present in the moment. And when that happens, you know, it can feel so liberating. It's just like all the chatter, when that mental chatter stops, you know, it feels really great. It feels really great. So at any rate, I think that's definitely, definitely true, right? That a lot of our early practice is being in the here and now, being in the moment. And I think one of the reasons Buddhism has become so popular in the modern world is because, you know, we already believe that this is the only life you get. This is the only world we're going to live in, and so on and so on. See? So I think that Buddhism kind of dovetails, or it meshes very well with, like, this idea that live for today, live for the moment, right? This is the only life you get, and so on and so on. And I think this is why Buddhism has become so popular. But you know, actually, there's a limitation to being, this is going to sound, there's kind of like a limitation to being in the moment. Yes, you know. I had a job that I stepped out of a few years ago, and it was an administrative job here at the university at Rutgers. And I actually worked in the same office, in the same desk, for 35 years. It got to be, I think I should have gotten out of that desk sooner than I did, right? Because it got to be so comfortable doing this job. Like the first maybe 10 years of the job was very challenging, right? You know, it seemed like every day some disaster was happening that I had to get on top of, or some challenge was happening. But, you know, after like a decade, you know, it was pretty much I could say, this will happen at 10 o'clock, this will happen at 11 o'clock, this will happen at 12 o'clock. And I got really like comfortable with that. And I don't have to tell you that, you know, things can get very stale, when you're in that situation. It's like back to the desk every day. When I went to lunch, I would go to the same place for lunch, you know, most of the time. Maybe I'd change, I'd go to a different restaurant down the street. You know, when you're repeating this moment over and over and over again, you know, you're developing really powerful habit energies, right? You're just doing the same thing over and over again. You develop these really powerful habit energies, and one of the things that can happen is that little by little, imperceptibly, it's like the life drains out of your life, right? The energy drains out of your life. So you know, one of the reasons people go on vacations is because, you know, they're doing this job for 10 years and they have to get out of the office and stop eating at the same restaurant, and so they'll go to some place. But you know, even vacations can become routine. You know, this when my wife had to have an operation last year, before we had the operation, we went to Europe on a tour. There's a wonderful tour guide named Rick Steves. He has a program on, he's had a program on television for 40 years. And he runs these tours mostly in Europe. And they're rather inexpensive, wonderful tours. You don't stay in five-star hotels, you stay in little hotels that are three stars, you know, and you ride a bus or you take the train, and they're it really wonderful. You carry your own bags and so on. It's really lovely. And we did it again this year, and it was just a little less. We went to a different place, right? Last year was one place. This year, a little different experience, but very similar, right? It wasn't quite as interesting, right? And then there's a lot of people who go on these Rick Steves tours, and they're like Rick Steves junkies, right? So there's a lot of retirees who have a fair amount of dough out there, right, and a fair amount of money, and they'll finish one Rick Steves tour, and then they'll get on another one. You know, we were actually with people like that. They said, yeah, we're not going back to the States right now. We finished our Rick Steves South of France tour, and now we're going to take the Italians, you know, the Italian Alps tour, you know, and I think that's wonderful. But, you know, it's, you know, you're on the way, right? You're on the way to a kind of, it's like the first time you do it, it was an adventure. The second time you do it, it's less of an adventure. The third time it's entertaining. And the fourth time it's sort of like a routine, right? You know the routine. So you know, actually, being in the moment, learning how to be in the moment is really important, really important. But, you know, if we're not careful, right, we can become prisoners of our habits, right, of our habits. You know, I have written so many memos in my job. You know, I used to joke with people that if only, you know, I could collect all my memos, it would be about 10 volumes of collected memos, but nobody would read them, you know, collected emails. You know, the first couple of years when I would send letters to people, you know, it was really challenging. I'd spend like a day writing a letter. I'd think about the audience. You know, I really wanted it to sound, you know, 10 years in, you're just banging out these letters and you wonder if anybody reads them. And it's like the life drains out, right? The life drains out. So you know, being in the moment is important, but it's only half of practice, you know, because the longer, you know, you stay in this moment, if I may say so, the more the life drains out of the moment, right? It's absolutely true. You know, when we try to stay in the moment, if you do stay in the moment, you know, eventually it just becomes empty or lifeless. Yeah. So, you know, I always think about Lu Zhu trying to communicate something really important, right? You know, all of these people are practicing mindfulness. You know, I read this article the other day. Just, this is not really changing the subject. I'm just taking a little detour, so hang on. You know, I read this article the other day about people who have done mindfulness meditation for 25 years or more. I've mentioned this before, and the psychologists were surprised to find that a significant number of these people have problems with depression. Yeah, depression. And this created quite a stir in, you know, psychology and psychotherapy circles, because everybody thought, you know, being mindful was supposed to be the solution to all our problems, being in the moment. And these people had been in the moment, you know, on the cushion, I think, maybe for 25 years, on, you know, give or take some days of where they were daydreaming and so on. You know, so the being in the moment, being mindful, may not be actually liberating unless we're doing something else too. You know, we can get trapped in our routines. Being in the moment is okay, but, you know, if you stay in that moment, it becomes lifeless. It becomes lifeless. Unless you know the secret of not being in the moment. Not being in the moment. Now, this is a little confusing because so far I've been saying, you know, when I wasn't in the moment, I was a scatterbrain, I was I was cut off from reality, you know, etc. But there's the person who is unable to be in the moment, and there's the person who is able to be in the moment, and they're at different places in their development. And once you're able to be in the moment, it's very important not to become a prisoner of the moment. Yes, you can become a prisoner of being in the moment. You know, when we Zen people don't strictly do mindfulness meditation, actually. We don't do that. You know, there's a dimension of mindfulness meditation in Zen. So like when we start, we're watching the breath, right? And we're mindful of breath. It's like you keep bringing your attention back. It's like Vipassana of breath, right? So we're watching the breath. But you know, at a certain point, we stop doing that and we do something very different. We start working with emptiness. And emptiness meditation is different from Vipassana, right? Because with Vipassana, you're watching the breath, or you're listening to the sound of the fan, or whatever, you're noting your physical sensations. With emptiness meditation, you start focusing on emptiness, on nothing at all, and your mind goes totally blank. And when your mind is totally blank, you are not in the moment. You are nowhere. You may even feel like when you are in deep samadhi, you may feel you can't even tell where you are. Sometimes you may wonder, where am I right now? And you can't feel your own body, and so on. That's not being in the moment. See, that's very liberating, right? And all kinds of things happen when you're not in the moment in that way. You know, so I've often said that the empty mind, that mushin, that blank mind, is the door into your unconscious, into your big unconscious. So you know, if I give you a koan, and I, you know, like, if I have a staff, if you have a staff, I will give you one, and if you have no staff, I will take it away. And you sit down on the cushion and you just say, give, take. You know, for a while you're aware of the room, you're aware of this, you know, the fan or whatever, but after a while you're not aware of those things. And you know, you may just be barely aware of give and take. And you know, for a long time you may be sitting in that blankness just saying give, take, but then, you know, all of a sudden something floats up, right? Like emotion. Like you may feel this powerful emotion, maybe like anger, you know, anger. And that's so important, right? We don't know where that anger is coming from, but it's like once you open the door to your unconscious, this anger comes through, right? And you know, if you continue to sit with the koan, you know, maybe the anger goes away, but you begin to have memories, right? You remember maybe being in the schoolyard and somebody used to bully you in front of the other students, and it would ruin your day, and you would go home and cry, and you didn't want to go to school. This very common happened to me, you know. So you know, now you're bringing to consciousness, right, a karmic obstacle that's really definitely preventing you from being more fully present in the world, right? So, you know, maybe around other people, you're very shy, you're a very diffident person. And you might not know why. And, you know, maybe it's because unconsciously you're expecting them to beat you up, right? You know, something like that. And you can say, well, I'm an adult, people don't beat me up anymore, but you're really that kid in the playground in a way still. So, you know, when we are not in the moment and we open up the door to our big mind, you know, we suddenly realize that these karmic obstacles, we have been carrying them through our lives. You know. And, you know, when we sit with those karmic obstacles, after a while they stop triggering emotional responses, conditioned responses. And it's like liberation. You suddenly feel relaxed again, calm. Yes, that kid used to beat me up on the playground, that's true. But now you're liberated. So I think that this Lu Zhu's koan is really about don't get trapped in the moment. Don't get trapped. The moment can become a trap. You know, every time we do something repetitively, we're creating what in Zen is called a vasana, or in Buddhism is called a vasana, habit energy. It's like, you know, if you, you know, if, you know, one of the, my father was a smoker and died of lung cancer, and I asked him when he was dying, you know, how did you get into smoking? And he said, you know, in the Navy during World War II, my father was stationed in the South Pacific. And he said, you know, I used to be on watch duty at night. You know, these sailors have to just stand on the deck all night and watch, make sure nobody's attacking or, you know. And he said, it's so boring, it's unbelievable. And he said, you know, I started smoking because it was interesting, right? You know, in other words, you know, you have this huge stretch of time. My father didn't know how to meditate, right? So he would just stand there. You couldn't, you know, read a book. You know, you're supposed to be watching for enemies. So, you know, the idea of, you know, taking out a cigarette and then, you know, a match or lighter and lighting the cigarette, so, you know, get a little hit of nicotine. It's so beautiful, actually. And even the smell of tobacco is very, very seductive. It's very interesting smell, very earthy, sweet. And, you know, my father said it just gave him something to look forward to, right? You get a little rush. And so you break up your day into these intervals where, you know, in another half hour I'm going to be able to have a smoke. I get a reward, something's coming, right? And this is creating energy habit, right? And we all do this, right? We all do this, and, you know, it's human, it makes sense. You know, you don't want to look for a new restaurant every day if you're at work, or you don't want to, you know, you park in the same place every time because you can find your car. You know, if you don't do that, you'll spend an hour looking for your car. You know, so that but the moment loses its freshness after a while, right? Because it's really just this is a little more complicated, but it's just an image of the moment. You know, actually, when we are in the moment, we're in our image of the moment. Lots of things going on that we aren't noticing. And we can become prisoners of the moment, you know, actually. And the more we try to repeat that moment, the more we strengthen our energy habits, our vasana. And then it becomes very hard to change, right? It becomes very hard to change. You know, on your 10th Rick Steves tour, you know, it may be very hard to risk going on a different kind of tour, to just get in the, fly into Paris and get in a car and drive south. Might be terrifying, you know. So it gets to be harder and harder to imagine a different way of, like, living. So Lu Zhu is saying, look, it's really important to be able to not be lost in your dreamy dreams, to be able to focus on the moment and be present in the moment. But it's very important to know how to get out of the moment into the next moment, and how to be ready to receive the next moment in a way that makes it fresh and alive. I've been doing Zazen for 49 years. And I would say it's, every sit is absolutely wonderful and fresh and different. And I look forward to tomorrow, tomorrow's meditation, you know. How does that happen, you know? I don't think it's the same thing as hanging out in my office too much. I really don't. You know, I know how to be in the moment, but I also know how to be in emptiness. And when you know how to be in emptiness, you are in contact with your deeper awareness, right, which is unconscious. And you know how to be ready for the next moment. You know, the next moment is a totally fresh moment if you know how to be in emptiness. If you know how to be in emptiness, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep mushin and everything disappears. Now, the next moment, you know, anything can happen, and you're ready. You have no expectations for or against anything. So, you know, you can now, having freed yourself from your energy habit, you can greet the next moment with open eyes, open heart, you know. And so, you know, you can do the same thing for 50 years and it can be a new experience every time. Or you can do the same thing for, a week, and it may be absolutely crushingly boring, depending on whether you know this little secret or not. So yeah, be in the moment, but also don't be in the moment. Very important how to be in the moment and how not to be in the moment. Bodhidharma's 9 years of facing a wall, staring at emptiness, is called Piquan, wall gazing. Shenguan's 3 bows divulge the natural potential. So, you know, when we can enter emptiness, we free ourselves from our habit energies. And then when we get off the cushion and act, we can act freely in a way that's not conditioned by the past. See? How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? How do you get free of your old habits? How to break free from habits? And you know, you can travel all over the world and still be trapped in your habits. You could sit in emptiness on the cushion for half an hour and it can be a different world, I would say. Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall, immediately go into emptiness. See? He said, "This, don't forget about this." Nanchuan hearing of this said, I usually tell them to realize mastery before they get into emptiness, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found 1.5. In other words, what he says is, I haven't been that successful either in my using my method. But Luzhu he'll never help anybody wake up. In other words, he's complimenting Luzhu. He's saying Luzhu has helped many people wake up. Verse, in plainness, in emptiness, there's flavor. Subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. Unbending like an idiot, his path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. See, habit takes all the freshness out of everything. But when we go back into emptiness, everything comes alive. A pearl in an abyss, see, emptiness, attracts of itself. This is Chinese mythology. But a pearl in the darkness generates its own light, you could say. Okay. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar.